How's it going?
It's going okay.
Pleasure to meet you. I'm so sorry it took so long. I feel like a piece of shit.
No.
I never have time because I never know what I'm doing the next day, so which makes it impossible to make a schedule. So like I try to fit things inside these little moments of time in between things.
No, this is great. I really appreciate it. You know, you're a highly requested guest for the show. There's a lot of people out there who are really sort of, they don't exactly know what you do, but they're on the precipice of kind of understanding its importance. So, I mean, yeah, if you want to introduce yourself, I mean, I can introduce you. This is Lewis Rossman of the Rossman Repair Group, right to repair activist, has an amazing YouTube channel. Yeah, I just kind of wanted to ask a few questions and do kind of just a basic general interview, if that's cool.
Yeah, it's great. Happy to do it. My name is Lewis Rossman. I run a company that fixes things. I started out by wanting to be a loudspeaker engineer, which makes loudspeakers. When I was a teenager, I mistook loudspeaker engineer for audio engineer. So I started going into the path of trying to record music for a living because I didn't even know the difference between these two things. I realized I sucked at that, but people saw that I was very, very good at solving random tech problems, even though I had virtually no experience. And I also got along so much better with the people that did the repairs. They were kind of like the old tradesman plumber types in New York City, like the old New York, and then versus the recording engineers and assistant engineers. They were kind of like the hipster-ish, like, you know, I have the actual original vinyl of that. It sounds better than your versions. Like, I was better at the tech side, and B, I could not fucking stand. It took like every bit of patience in my body to not just, when somebody would talk to me down to me like that, just not push them down a flight of stairs. So I wound up working in the tech room with like some of the greats in the industry, like Ricky Began, Gretchen Mathwich, Phil Lipscomb, Roy Hendrickson. Truly inspiring people. I would have been a shit technician if I did not work with the amazing people there. I wound up leaving because I realized I could work here for probably 10 years and I'd still be making minimum wage. I was 17 and everybody there that was below 26 years old got called one of the kids. So I just kind of realized I could spend 8 years here and I'll be one of the kids. It was like a great place to learn and I loved it, but I feel like I reached a cap. I went back to the small recruiting studio I was at where I thought maybe I'd have a chance to make a difference here. And then the financial crisis happened. So like 4 months later, it just closed altogether. And I was finishing up a session for somebody, and that session that I was finishing up required that I have a Mac. I'm broke because I work in the music industry, so like everybody's broke in there, especially as a teenager. So I bought something on eBay. It arrived broken because most people selling shit on eBay are scammers. I get it. I wind up getting a small discount. I fix it. I no longer needed it after I finished this Logic session, so I sold it, and I made about $200, $250. And I thought, I'm broke. I don't think I've made more than $400 to $600 a month on in W-2 pay in my life. And I just made $250 for that. Let's try that again. And I kept trying. And I never thought of making a business of actually doing repairs until my good friend Dimitri at New York City iPod Doctor calls me and says, I was saying, how do you make any money doing this? Because all these places have these rates. And he's like, they're all lying. Call every single one of these places up. And when it says $149, they'll say, oh, that's if you want the part. It's actually $200 for us to do this. So I actually started calling all of them and I started emailing them. And then I made a website that was a compilation of every single one of these websites completely bullshitting you and saying, we will do this whole thing for $149. And then like a call recording of me saying, asking that. And then them saying, oh, yeah, it's $300, it's $400 or whatever. And it's going to take 2 weeks. And I'm just thinking, I am like I'm a 19-year-old kid in basketball shirts that has no money, but I have to be able to do better than this. And I just lost my job. So that kind of, yeah, like that was the beginning of me working out of a park in 2008 because I had no office and just putting up pull tab signs and all the around all the areas. At some point, I actually went to H&M and I got a bright blue polo shirt and I would walk into the Apple store on 9th Avenue and 14th Street. And I would just look for the people that looked like they were really pissed off and I talked to them about their issue. And then like after 10 minutes, I'd say, by the way, I do not work here. Here's my card. You need an inverter board. I can replace that for $75. They're probably going to tell you $750 for display assembly. You know, wait for them to tell you that. And then like, you know, things went on from there.
Your story is so similar to mine because I came from the music world. I remember the financial crisis. It cut my job in half. I was barely making any money. I was living in Oakland, you know, in this tiny bedroom, basically a closet. And, you know, I got this guitar amp and it was broken and I fixed it and I bought a repair manual and I was like, you know what? I'm going to actually take time to learn schematics and diagrams and learn how to fix things. And I was like, I just made $600 off flipping this thing. And I just kept doing it. So I became this like Craigslist hustler who was just finding broken crap and flipping it on eBay. And I turned that into a business for 10 years. I worked in the technical department for amplifier companies, you know, so it actually kind of similar in like you said with music engineering. I try to produce music. I'm just a guitar player. I suck at it. Anything that has to do with knobs and stuff like software wise, but if it's hardware, I can maybe fix it. And I think that that's going to really come back. And right in your advocacy for right to repair, I think you're sort of on the foreground of that. So how does that sort of fit in with things? Where are things going? I think it's the most important legislative issue domestically that we face, probably at least consumers. And like, why is it that consumers are getting effed so bad? And like, what can we do about it? Because I remember I could repair all my own stuff. Now I can't repair any of it.
If I were to dig down into my most pessimistic but realistic idea of why this is happening, every single company seems to have gotten much better and more efficient at what they do. So for instance, I am not kidding myself. I know that the reason that I am able to get the parts that I am is this company was told to make 15,000 of this because they were supposed to manufacture, but then they realized they could only manufacture 14,500 of this thing today. So somebody kick something out the door, who sells it to somebody, who sells it to somebody, who then sells it to us. Like the entirety of the supply chain of what we get is dumpster diving. There's this one article from The Information in 2018. I'm never going to forget this because this is verified by people that I buy from, where they were talking about people that were sneaking shit out. And they were going through these underground tunnels. They were sneaking shit out of the factories that they were sticking into their underwear. So there are these, let's say you have a board that is not going to be usable again. They'll grind it down into dust and then recycle the bare metals. But that's kind of useless. Let's say that board doesn't work because it has a microfracture in it, and that's why it got thrown away. I could still use the chips off of that. I would like the rest of the chips off of that. I mean, there's a lot of useful stuff on there. And so these people will see that waste, and they'll literally break the boards into pieces. They'll put it in their pants and sneak it out of there. And like, so the entire method that's been used for us getting stuff has simply been things being thrown away that shouldn't have been thrown away. It's not... Like as time has gone on, companies have gotten more efficient. Like if we're making 14,500 today, 14,500 parts are showing up. That's it. It's not like the company has made excess of something and now has the ability to sell the rest of it to the side. I'm sure, I haven't seen the contracts, but something tells me that these contracts with these companies say, listen, if you're making this for us, you can't sell it to other people. And I'm also sure that if there was no paper trail and that company just so happened to sell those parts to other people, They do it and take the money. The entire supply chain for this is kind of like Nicolas Cage, that movie Lord of War. People don't get that. They just think that we're nerds, that we go to support.apple.com/buy, and that's where I buy a CD3217 or an ISL6259 chip. But that's not how it works at all. So I don't think that the companies originally said we are going to destroy repair. I just think it was constantly, how do we make things more efficient, more efficient, more efficient, more efficient? And teaching people how to do repairs properly, it probably goes away from their core mission. Now, once you're made aware of how this problem is hurting people and you choose to ignore it, that's where it kind of becomes intentional. So like with this CBC News piece that happened in 2018, where they showed somebody getting billed $1,300 to $2,000 for what was a bent pin and display connector. This, if that happens once, you could say, okay, that's because of a bad practice. But when it happens over and over and over and over and over again, and people keep telling you about it and you don't change it, that's where the whoops, my bad moment of just not ignorance, or that whole don't attribute to malice, but could be attributed to stupidity, becomes malice. Because if you ignore incompetence long enough and you just pretend it's not there, it becomes that way. So the TLDR of that ridiculous rant over there is, I think that things are becoming less repairable because A, companies see that they can get away with it. B, the attempt to make everything as efficient as possible, just-in-time manufacturing doesn't really consider repairability in it. And I also don't think that consumers realize it as an issue until it's too late. Everybody in my comments is like, what are you, poor? Why don't you just buy a new one? Why don't you just not be clumsy and break your stuff? Oh, you're an idiot. You didn't back this stuff up. But like when it happens to them, it hits them. It's one of those problems that people don't care about until it personally affects them. Like once somebody shows up to my store and then like, I had no idea that the part that I needed was $5 and Apple wanted $1,500 kind of thing. Like then they see it, but it's a very small percentage of people that actually see it as a problem. They only see it when it personally affects them. So what you also decided, the other thing is, like, even though the cultural awareness of right to repair has gone up incredibly over the years, the actual repairability of stuff just continues to slide down and down and down. So I'm trying to win the cultural battle because I realize the legal battle is almost a meme at this point.
That's amazing. And one of the things that you've kind of just watching your videos is you don't actually, you kind of outlined it, how you sort of like don't necessarily believe in planned, like the obsolescence is just planned by this like group of, you know, evil people coordinating. They're just sort of reacting to bottom lines. That's something that I think about a lot that you've actually sort of brought to my attention, because I was more under the impression that these consumer items were, there was some sort of overarching grand scheme of things. Like, this is going to last 5 years. But when you do certain updates on phones, for example, like the stuff breaks, you know, like it barely can work. iPhones barely work after 5 years. So is there like sort of a concerted effort on the software side? Because this is something that, and you also talk about like this sort of hidden side of things. People go, well, why can't you just buy that? It's a cheap consumer item. Well, if essentially something is unrepairable, then you don't actually own it. You're a renter of this commodity that ends up in a landfill in Jakarta, Indonesia, off the coast of, you know, the Ivory Coast. And so there is a sort of consumerist waste issue as well. You know, we have too much crap. We're polluting the planet. If I would rather the stuff be more expensive and you can fix it yourself, because at least then you own it.
I wonder if that's actually the case in real life when people would see the prices. Because if there's anything I've learned in 15 years is people will say, people vote what they say what they want, but then they vote with their wallet on what they actually will buy. I think the big problem, I don't think it's when it comes to repair, and then there's a planned obsolescence in general. When it comes to repair, I think that because we didn't have just-in-time manufacturing and all that stuff as good as it is now, we may have the demand existed to make 1.2 billion of this product, and we've made 1.21 billion of this charging IC. And then that extra 0.01 billion winds up being used for everybody to be able to do repairs. But I think what's happened with all the optimization of supply chains is if we want to make 1.2 million of this model MacBook, like, we are going to order exactly 1.2 billion of this chip to be made. And there's no need for them to keep up the spare capacity, the ability to make this chip if it's only going into one product. I think that is a big part of it. However, there is also the opposite, the other end of it. You know, like, I'll give the devil its due with that. But why is it if somebody contacts, a Rochester Electronics, I forget the exact name, somebody did this in a video of mine in 2019, they had a bunch of emails of them going back and forth with them and them going back and forth on Facebook, and they said, I'm sorry, this product is only for one client, we can't sell it to you. Well, why not? I mean, I'm not trying to make a MacBook, I'm trying to make my current MacBook charge. The manufacturer wants $1,500 for this. So like those things have to get looked at. And it's not malice in the beginning. It's just we want to run a more efficient company. We want the S&P to keep going up so that people can keep making money for doing nothing. We want the stock market to go up. We want our business's valuation to go up. We want to make more profit. That part I'm not mad at. You should try to become a more efficient business. I want to become a more efficient business.
Right.
But there are things you can do along the way, in my opinion, that allow you to become more efficient, but also would allow somebody like me to do my job. Like, let me ask Renesas themselves, hey, I want to buy 100,000 of this chip. I will wire you the money. I expect zero warranty whatsoever. I'm doing a wire transfer. I cannot ask for this back. There is no escrow. Allow me to take on that risk myself. Allow me to have that conversation with one of the chip manufacturers or the panel manufacturers or vendors. Because a big part of the problem, even with a lot of these right to repair programs, is it's very hard to legislate don't be an asshole. So right now, Apple has released a repair program, right? And a lot of people that I know are actually using it for certain items. If they need to replace a board for a customer, it's not a bad deal if you need to replace it. But if I need to fix a board, I want a $5 chip. I want a $15 or $20 or 50 cent chip. I don't need a $500 or $600 board to replace. So even if you say make parts available, well, what does that mean? I mean, does that mean a processor with the motherboard soldered in together on a laptop? Does that mean the processor by itself? Now, if you have a processor that's randomly crashing, does that mean the individual transistor inside of there? Like, how do you word that kind of stuff to discuss the component, how deep you want to go? Apple will make a screen assembly available, but I don't need the screen. You didn't break the hinges. You didn't break the webcam. You didn't break the bezel. You didn't break the Apple logo in the back. You broke the screen. The screen is $38 to $72, and that's when a schmuck like me is buying it. you don't need the $300 to $500 or $600 assembly. But the thing is, they're telling you we're making the part available. And what a lot of companies do now is just to keep things less complex, we'll make the assembly available to you. You've technically complied with the law. You've complied with the letter of it, but have you complied with the spirit of it? And that's part of why I think the cultural battle is where you win. Because in so many different industries, you'll see this shit where even when a company does make things like more available, more repairable, it's when you look at the economics of it, it makes no sense. And they'll be able to say, well, this screen assembly cost $400 to build and we're giving it to you for $420. And it's like, true. Okay, I'm not saying that's not true, but I wasn't asking for that. I was asking for this thing over here. Take that $20 part and sell it to me for $100. I'll be happy. But I don't want the $400 or $600 of shit that I don't need.
It's also interesting because, you know, as consumer items and technological items get more complex, you know, we've sort of gone away from like through-hole components and now everything's surface mount. It's actually harder to replace these chips because, you know, you can fry things, even heat sink stuff, you just fry it out, you know, on the board once you replace it. So I think economically, because they're also trying to get these products tinier and tinier and more portable, that also has kind of like that sort of hinders our ability to repair these items as well. But it's interesting because, you know, Steve Wozniak of Apple actually kind of like co-signed you for your right to repair stuff. Is this kind of what he proposed? He was like, well, you know, we're going to sell you these boards for upcharged. And even though you have the skills to repair them yourselves and replace maybe like a resistor or some sort of capacitance item on the board, you know, but it's also interesting. You talk about like the culture behind it. How do we get people into this stuff? Like I'm trying to convince artists. I'm trying to, you know, because open source stuff, you know, with DeepSeek, that changes the game for a lot of people, you know, what China's basically been able to do with AI. How does that sort of change things on the hardware side of things?
On the hardware side of things, when we're talking about everything becoming miniaturized and more difficult to repair, that part, I'm okay. There's two different ways to look at that. There's two different issues. The first issue is when something is made intentionally difficult to repair, and the second is technology advancing. And people tend to conflate the two when I complain about this particular issue or criticize it. If technology gets smaller, that's fine. They're like, that's a skill issue. That's on me. There are people that used to fix, I'll just give a really old example. If you have a MacBook where the screen backlight is flickering and goes out, that used to be you would replace an inverter board. It takes the low DC voltage and turns it into a higher AC voltage for the fluorescently backlit panel. That requires a screwdriver and two fingers. Like it's just boop, boop, easy. The part is this big. And when it comes to modern boards, it is an LED driver chip made by Texas Instruments sometimes that is about a quarter the size of my pinky fingernail and has a bunch of balls under it. So you can't even do it with a normal soldering iron. You need a hot air station. You need to understand what you're doing so you don't burn everything around it. You need the chip to not blow away. You need to understand what you're doing, especially if it's a burnt out thing. Let's say one of the pads is missing for feedback or something. You have to run a jump run to the chip. Is that more annoying? Yes. But that's not something I have the right to complain about. I'm a repair technician, right? And I say that this is what I want to do professionally. It's on me to get the tools and the skills necessary to be able to do that repair. I don't get to bitch about the fact that the shit gets smaller. Now, when it comes to shop talk, yes. You will go into one of these places and hear people screaming and losing their shit over everything being fucking glued together and having to take like a little fucking putty knife and use that to separate the bezel. And if you're like a quarter of a millimeter off over here, it breaks into the backlight layer. And you have to, yeah, like that. But that's shop talk. That's not like movement talk. As everything gets more difficult to repair, that's on us. We got to get better at all that, and that's fine. We're willing to do that. The stuff that we reject is the intentional barriers that have no benefit to the consumer or us. When you tell a company, don't make chips available to us, even if we want to come up with our own terms, that's the shit we're pushing back against.
Right.
When you require that this piece be calibrated by a tool to this piece to work, I'm not complaining the calibration routine exists. Again, that's a skill issue. I got to get access to that. I complain when you don't make that tool available. So there's a difference between intentional barriers to repair and technology just becoming more advanced with time. Because if you have parts that have insanely tight tolerances, maybe you do need a calibration device. Maybe you do need a calibration routine. Make that available to the customer. Include a disc in the box with all that, with a manual on how to do that stuff. I bought it. I should be able to do that. And you should be able to choose who does that. As everything gets smaller and more difficult to work on, like That's all on me. I remember Ricky Began at Avatar. He was one of the best techs I ever met in my life. He's the only one that could get a neat, you know, shout out to him for being the only person that didn't leave toothpicks and sewing needles in the knee VRP switches, because everybody else used to put toothpicks and sewing needles in the knee VRP switches all across New York. He was the only one that could fix that stuff right. And even he told me, he said, you know, all this surface mount shit is too small, all this stuff's going to go away. He told me that back in 2007. And I went way less talented than him. He's an electronics engineer, but, you know, went to school for it, a genius at it, has 30 years experience. And me as an idiot, I'm sitting here with a microscope and doing all the stuff that he said is impossible. Like, we'll get that stuff. We'll get the skills needed for that. Right. Now, with regards to getting people excited about it, it's just like any activism. You cannot tell people what to think. It's impossible. I've made this right. mistake at other points in my life. You cannot tell people what to think. You have to plant a seed. If I say you should do this, why are you replacing this and you can fix it, that's bad. That's bullshit. The way that you get people excited about something is when they get screwed over and you just point this out. Like, if somebody gets screwed over on something and somebody wants to charge them $3,000 to fix this issue with their air conditioning, when the only issue is, I don't know, like, I'm not an HVAC tech, so this is going to be cringe, but like the boot capacitor or something like that, or like that little relay that turns the thing on in the beginning that kicks it on when you send 24 volts over from your thermostat. When that contactor, I think that's what it's called. HVAC people in the audience are gonna fuck me up, but I think it's like a contactor. You buy the shit for like $30 to $150. When they figure out, oh, by the way, this is the issue, and then you show them how to fix it themselves, or you get an HVAC tech who does it in total like $200 or $300. It's like, these people wanted to charge you $1,500 to $3,000. They think you're stupid. They right. think that you're too stupid to do this. They think you're too stupid to find somebody to maintain what you bought and paid for. And here's how they're screwing you. Like, you let them, I can't tell you that you're getting screwed. I need to let you come to that conclusion on your own. And it's very easy to paint that story when that's the reality. And then when that happens, now I have somebody that's set for life. Because not only did they save money, but they also got that dopamine kick from figuring it out for themselves. I can't tell you what to think, but I can lead right. you there by showing, here's the situation you're in. Here's how to make your situation better. And then at the end of it, like, they'll get it.
Right. And there's also a dopamine kick that comes from the fact that, you know, you are kind of sticking it to somebody. You could be like, well, these guys are making hundreds of millions of dollars. You know, they're just increasing their rate of profit, you know, based off the fact that they can get away with screwing you. And you can just sort of point at them and be like, hey, you know, this guy's making all this. Meanwhile, they're ripping you off for this. So I think that could actually sort of be like a cultural motivator as well.
Yeah, I think people respond very well to being like, they don't respond well to being told what to think, and they don't respond very well to, here's why you should care about this, because, you know, save the whales or something. Like, I'm not right. saying that shouldn't, but just the way people yeah. work is people are motivated when they are personally screwed, they're personally slighted, or when they have been told they're an idiot, or when something has hurt them. You know, people respond to their own self-interest, what affects their ego, what affects their wallet. What they don't respond to, again, like, you know, the whole, you should care about this because. I like the whales. I like the dolphins. I want to see more dolphins. But your average person, if you say you should do this because it'll save the dolphin, they're like, yeah, fuck this. You know, like, throw their beer can out the window with the plastic on it. Like, this is
right.
It doesn't for a lot of people, they just don't change their minds.
Yeah. How do you? That's a really interesting point. So you just kind of like, one of the things that you start with all of your most of your YouTube videos is like, hi, this is how you're getting effed. You know.
That was started as a meme, and then it actually became, like, somebody suggested that, and then it actually just became a thing, because I realized, you know, right to repair is a very small element under a larger umbrella. So I used to just have a channel where I just would just talk about whatever's on my mind that day, and then that started to turn into thoughts of my business. Thoughts of my business turned into a repairability of items. And then at one point, I can't tell you exactly when, it just turned into this question of, why do I have to go through a Nicolas Cage Lord of War supply chain to be a nerd who buys a screen? Like, I can't believe I didn't ask that question in 2008. It was somewhere around 2014 that I finally asked the question. And this is after I ran a supply company that was selling thousands of screens a day. Why can't I just knock on the door of one of these companies and just buy the part? I'm not even saying buy onesies and twosies. I mean, why can't I say, I'm not saying I have the money, but why can't I just say, here, I want to wire you $20 million to get a pallet of this. I will wire it to you. There is zero warranty expectation whatsoever. You're in another country. I can't do shit to you. Why does that, like, why can't anybody do that? And then around 2014 is when I started really pushing back on that and asking the question. And that was when I started posting a lot more of the board repair videos that I was doing. And you know, it didn't show up immediately. It kind of showed up later.
That's super interesting. So you started out in music production and music engineering and audio engineering. Like, what are some of your, what is some of your favorite equipment to work on? Like, what were some like things that got you interested in it? Because one of the things that I was always really interested in is like Universal Audio, the Putnam tube boards, David Briggs, he would sort of, you know, patch things directly just through the tubes and let it all run live. Like, what got you interested in just kind of like basic electronics? Was it from a cultural place, or was
it? I actually don't like being a repairman. I'll be honest with you.
You don't like it? Wow.
No, I mean, like, this is the in my own house, I'm the exact opposite. I don't fix things. There is so much shit in my garage where I could have just fixed it and I just bought another one. Right to repair is not the requirement to. I don't like in fixing things. What I like is I like seeing the smile on somebody's face when they get their baby pictures back, or from somebody who had died and they didn't back it up. I like when somebody who couldn't afford $5,000 bill gives me a giant hug because the issue was $75 and everybody else told them they needed to pay $3,000. It's about the outcomes. There's this idea with what you want to do for a living, that if you have to find the thing you're doing, you have to be passionate about it. And I hate that passion word. I'm not passionate about what I do. I don't even like it. I mean, who can enjoy running a, seriously, like, you want to take a fucking chip that's the size of your thumb that has 96 little 0.2 millimeter balls under it and manually put 96 balls on it? It's not fun. You want to run a jumper wire into that? None of that stuff is fun. What I find fun about what I do is the combination of three things. I get to help people that otherwise wouldn't have been helped. I get to figure out a puzzle, and I get to give a middle finger to authority. Like, you combine these three things together, and I really enjoy it. I like that part of it. I like I like helping people that otherwise wouldn't have been helped. I like being able to see the smile in their face. I like when people would walk up to me and say, my repair shop, you know, I was a noob. I used to make $40,000 a year, and now I make $90,000 a year because I added board repair and I stopped outsourcing it. That's the stuff I find fun. The actual running of the jumper wire, like, fuck that. I hate that. I mean, I'll do it. It's not what gets me fired up. Also, I realized that I completely brain farted on the last question, and I forgot the question halfway through it. Your thing was on the right to repair thing. Like, right to repair is kind of when you said about the how you're getting after. I literally forgot the question there. Wow, I spaced. But yeah, it started with like business stuff, then right to repair stuff, then it just turned like right to repair for Apple stuff turned into app right to. I started meeting people from the medical industry and John Deere at these legislative hearings, and then that just turned into this discussion of you know, everything being a subscription and every company changing the terms of the sale, trying to take away your rights to say that you own what you own. And eventually I started to notice the little thing that I was talking about really just kind of went under this umbrella of you being able to say you own anything. Whether you can't fix something. Yeah, I really wish I not forgot what I was talking about in that sentence. That sucked. Whether it's not saying that you can, whether it's taking a perpetual license and taking it away from you and turning it into a subscription, whether it is a product that could just be remotely turned off due to cloud services, or whether it's not being able to fix what you own, it all goes under that same freaking umbrella of you don't own what you bought and paid for. So this channel over the past 15 years really just turned into man screams at camera to this whole kind of general consumer protection. Like, it's not just about me talking about Apple. It's not about me. It's not about my repair business. It's how in every single field of society now, the concept of ownership is being eroded away and people are not really noticing it the way that I think they should.
What economic, broad sort of economic program you think would sort of solve these structural issues? Because they're moral and they're ethical and they're social, but I think that they go kind of deeper than that, in just on a just a very sort of material basis. It's like, is it that just, you know, capital buys our politicians? It's able to sort of lobby. Like, do we need to subordinate all financial organs to the state or to the political apparatus? Like, how do we control this thing? I think this is kind of like the big question. And I think this is especially with,
because it's easy.
What?
I think lobbying gets, sorry, I cut you off, my bad.
No. It's also just, a lot of people are bringing this up because of this, you know, efficiency of China also.
Well, a lot of people blame lobbying immediately because I think it's the easiest thing to do. I mean, to be clear, I'm not blaming normal people. A normal person has a job. They work 40 to 50 hours a week. Yeah, like they work 40 to 50 hours a week. They have a job. that they already have to deal with. They maybe go into school on the side. They have their wife, their husband, their kids, their friends. And every now and then, they might just want to get 6 hours of sleep. So they don't have time to take off and go to a legislative hearing. There was this one person, Joel Stekas, in 2020. He said something in Maine. He was one of the state senators. He's like, you know, only one person from our state showed up to this hearing to talk about this. Okay, well, how do you figure out that hearing? You got to go to legiscan.com to even figure out when the hearings are half the time, or go to your local government website, which usually looks like something that was put together in 1997 that's updated once every 3 years. You have to take off work to show up to this hearing. And a lot of people don't get paid sick leave, so or they get in trouble, or they really have to put in a favor with their boss so that they could show up to a hearing. That when you have lobbyists that get paid $300,000 a year and their only job show up to every hearing and make a presentation. Yeah, of course, you know, people are not going to show up. But when you have people show up, it starts to make a difference. When you have 20 or 40 or 100 or 1,000 or 10,000 people write into their legislative reps and actually show up to the hearings, it does something. Paid lobbyists have an effect on things, but it's not this under-the-table thing where they're bribing each other the way people think it is. It's that nobody shows up. I mean, I remember in New York State in 2015, I remember thinking this is all BS. I showed up I wasn't even wearing a tie. I didn't have a belt, my hair. I looked like a schmuck. I had never done lobbying in my life. And I talked to this one person, and he says, I just decided I'm just going to bring a motherboard, a page of a schematic. The motherboard had a wire on it, which made it really easy to see what I fixed, and a charger. It has a fan attached to it, and there's the banner on my ad channel that jokes about, you know, fan spinning, it's done. I show them the board, and I say, if I take off this wire, fan doesn't spin. I put it on, fan spins, and it boots. The document that would allow me to see this and change this, you know, job that Apple wants $1,500 for, and is something that's more affordable in a few hundred dollars, is this document. And he says, well, the Apple lobbyist, and I'm sure a little bit of Babelfish happened here because this guy was in his 70s or 80s, and he was upfront that he did not understand technology. He said that this is a little bit of Babelfish probably, but to a game of telephone, he said that the Apple lobbyist said that when I'm working on this board and I do this in a video, that I'm taking a MacBook and I'm turning it into a PC. And then I'm misrepresenting it as if it's still a MacBook to my customer after I fix the board. And I did my best to not just kind of blow my stack like a Looney Tunes character in front of him. And I composed myself and I said, okay, like, you know, what about that argument was compelling to you? And he said, well, you know, I didn't know any better because nobody came here to tell me. And then I just see him looking down and he's writing on a piece of paper. And I'm like, you know, I thought he wasn't paying attention to me for 10 seconds. I'm like, what is that? And he's like, I'm signing your bill, dumbass. And he co-sponsored it.
Wow.
So it doesn't take it really does not take a lot of effort. It's just who the hell has the time for this shit? So when it comes to lobbying, I think considering it as some evil grand conspiracy where somebody's giving a politician $800,000 into the table every time they check something, like, that's this oversimplified thing. And the more I stay in this, the more I work in this, the more I realize the oversimplified explanations, they make me feel better, but that's not it. It's if you get enough people organized around something and you get them to say, this is the specific issue, this is exactly the way that we want this fixed, then you get it. It's kind of like the healthcare thing. Like, I don't want to turn it into this shit, but because that's a mess in and of itself. You say, hey, you know, do you want universal healthcare? Absolutely. Do you want the government to be the only provider of healthcare? No. And so it becomes a difficult issue because people are pissed off at how things are. You can ask the same question two different ways to get radically different answers. And here, well, okay, how do you make right to repair legislation? A lot of people want this shit, but how do you do it? How do you make something that makes sense? I want to be able to access the screen, not the display assembly. Okay, but how do you do that? Like, am I allowed to ask for an individual subpixel? Like, how do you write a law that gives me what I want without simultaneously being completely ridiculous? Now, you could say, well, make a law that says whatever the manufacturer's authorized repair centers get access to, I get access to. Okay, but the manufacturer authorized repair center doesn't get access to shit. Now, I could do something where I say, well, now the manufacturer's reverse logistics department gets access to what I want, but not the authorized repair center. So now I have to go back and rewrite the bill. This stuff's really difficult to do. It's really difficult to get together. And paid lobbyists, what they'll do is they'll show up and they're there every single day bullshitting the senators. And they're telling them, if you get this passed, here's all the blowback there's going to be. Here's all the negative effects it's going to have on the economy. Here's all the negative effects it'll have in the court system. And they don't want that shit. They want wins for their base. And they don't want to take on something that's a high risk of having doing damage, clogging up the court system, screwing up companies that are doing business and creating tax revenue and jobs. They're not going to take that risk unless, A, you've really thought through your shit. Not just here's the problem, but here's exactly how to fix it without creating all these undesired side effects. Right. And B, you got to have people show up. And every time we've gotten people to actually show up in an organized way, things change in a very interesting, in a really good way.
And, that's amazing.
We need more of that. Like people.
When you say showing up, do you mean just kind of like morally, or does everybody have to sort of know the ins and outs and be able to kind of explain these things? Because your average senator has very little sort of technical knowledge as well. You know, it's not like.
It's almost unrealistic when people say this senator, this person doesn't know about that topic. There are thousands of topics that you are going to be creating legislation on as a senator or as a congressperson or as a House representative. And you can't be an expert in all of these. It's impossible.
Of course.
If I, you know, even if you take one of the smartest people, this is, you often see this where somebody's incredibly smart in this field. And then in this field, it's like they know less than my cat. And, but this is common. One person can't know everything about everything. It's not possible. So the whole idea, I think, behind lobbying in the olden days was there's something like, I need somebody to inform me on the matters of which I know nothing. And I think at some point in time, it may have actually been possible that that's what they did. Now you have somebody reading from a script. Is this some ridiculous, nonsensical PR thing that doesn't really have any basis in reality? But the idea of having a group of people that will tell me when I don't know what the hell I'm talking about, that's useful. No senator, no congressperson is going to know everything. And even when it comes to the laws they write, politicians that did not start as lawyers, they have legislative aides that are writing these bills and laws that they're presenting for them. So you need to have people that will show up. And when I say show up, I mean in person. Somebody to show up and actually talk to them in person, and have lots of people show up to talk in person. If you can't do that, show up via email and phone call. If somebody gets 1,000 phone calls and three of them are from their district, they don't care. And that's another, you know, when you organize on Reddit and you talk about getting a certain law passed in a certain state. If I'm an Arizona state senator and I see that out of the 10,000 phone calls I got, that 9,998 of them are from numbers, that area codes that are not my state, it's like, why do I care? You have to get people organized in that particular area. That means getting people in that area to A, acknowledge this is an issue, B, admit that it's worth showing up for, C, agree on what the actual fix will be, and D, ensure that when they agree on what the actual fix is, that that makes sense. Because it has to make sense for both parties, because if it doesn't make sense for both parties, you're screwed. If I get a bill passed that requires that Apple provide me the individual transistors inside of an, that's written in a way where it's like, I really can ask you for the individual transistors inside of an M2 chip, like that doesn't do us any good, because some jackass out there is going to troll the crap out of them until the point of even a company like that going bankrupt. You get the, like, that's probably an extreme example. You get the point. You have to come up with a law that makes sense for everybody. And I'm not saying compromise to the point where Apple can just screw people, but I mean, you have to have something that makes sense. And that's a really difficult thing to do.
How do you navigate this? Because John Deere, you know, one of the things that they sort of stated in you, you actually went through this with them, is that they basically made this claim that, you know, self-repairing tractors can cause, you know, physical harm to them, and it creates a sort of liability lawsuit scenario. How do you skirt around that? Because I do know that in Colorado, they just passed, I think Massachusetts as well, they passed some pretty, I don't want to say extensive, but they you know, significant, you know, AG tech repair legislature. So like, how do you get around that? Because there are times when, you know, I was digging in a, you know, tube amplifier and I didn't discharge the capacitors and they're stored up, you know, a lot of volts, and I just touch it and I'm like, almost blows me back. So, I mean, is there any way to kind of get around that as well? Because in my opinion, it's like, hey, you take this on, at a certain point, it's your responsibility, you know, like if you want to actually repair something, you have to deal with the ramification. I mean, that doesn't mean you have to turn the product into like a Venus flytrap or something so that it like consumes you and kills you on purpose. But like, how do you navigate that too? So.
But the John Deere one's an interesting one, because one of the things that you hear them say is emissions. We need these things for emission standards and controls. And there's a lot, you know, there's truth and then there's bullshit in there. So if you look at there's one video I did where I'm actually reading through the law, the actual law, and it says that you can't use emissions stuff as an excuse to keep people from being able to work on these types of diesel devices. Like that's like, let the EPA do that. The EPA, the police, John Deere is not. At the same time, if you have a tractor and you make it to the, Like if I have to pay $5,000 or $10,000 to repair my emission system so that I do not have a tractor that just shoots out black smoke all the time, whereas the bypass cost me $70, like I get their argument. The EPA is not out there in the field to see if every single farmer is doing this but the point of there is that John Deere is not going to be held accountable. If I decide to do some sort of cheap hack on my tractor so that it's puffing up these giant clouds of smoke everywhere, it's up to the EPA to fuck me in the ass about that. It's not up to John Deere. You're not the policeman.
Right.
And that's the point that needs to be hammered home. It's John Deere is not going to be the one that gets a fine. The law is not written that way. A farmer is. And like that's not your job. You're not here to police what I do with my property. There are police that exist for that, and they issue ridiculously giant fines to people who screw with these types of laws. It's not John Deere's job to enforce that. And I think there may be this kind of idea that John Deere has to be the policeman because it's easier to restrict you from doing it and piss you off on repair than it is for the EPA to be out there with binoculars looking for every smokestack. Or so. That's just my theory. To be clear, I'm not a farmer, and I'm just trying to steel man their argument rather than just constantly say the same thing. Like if I was the steel man, that would be it. But at the end of the day, I don't think any of that matters because A, this shit winds up getting applied to a lot more than just emissions. This is an issue with so many different devices and so many different industries that have nothing to do with carbon footprint. And B, let's say it did have something to do with that. Does that mean that we just widespread give up our freedom to do what we need to do with what we bought and paid for? I don't think so.
Right. Another question. So you moved from New York City to Austin, Texas. What prompted that move? Would you say that do you like it here? Like, what are your thoughts? Because, I live in the same city. So I was just sort of wondering, what prompted you to come to Texas?
I didn't really start traveling around much for a very long time. I did not spend a lot of time traveling because I was, as a teenager, I don't have the money or a car or anything to travel across the country. I started working when I was 17. I started working in the music industry, all doing the standard 70 to 80 hour work week so I can rub two sticks together to buy food because there's no money in that. It wasn't until, I think, 2010 or 2011 that I really got to fly around a little bit and see other areas of the country. And it was just nice to see that there are areas where people are not just vibrating with stress and anxiety all the time. It was a different feeling. You're sitting on the subway, and I'm in a car of 90 people. And it's a diverse group of people. And all these people are here from different walks of life trying to pursue their dream. And it's silent. And every single person there is just vibrating with anxiety. And if you were to say, hi, how are you? They'd look at you like, why are you talking to me? Like, what do you want out of me? What do I have to... I remember going to, I think it was Allentown, Pennsylvania. I forget exactly. We were driving to visit someplace there. And I go to this gas station grocery store. And somebody looks at me and they're smiling at me. She's just smiling at me out of nowhere. And I said, you should try this flavor. It's better than the coconut one. For whatever I was drinking. She's like, I'll do that. Thank you. I'm like, I forget her name. Like, Mary, how are you? And just... I actually looked behind me because my first thought after spending all this time in Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn, or anywhere else in New York City is, okay, your boyfriend's behind me like slowly picking my pocket right now. There's no way in hell you're actually being nice to me.
Right.
And when you go to the rest of the country, you see that stuff. So New York City has certain opportunities you will not get anywhere else. Like, you have 8.5 million people in a space the size of Knoxville, Tennessee, and there's a lot of money there.
Right.
There's a lot of people coming from all different over the world, from all walks of life, with all different interests that are all showing up in this one place with one thing in mind. I want to work 80 hours a week to build my own shit so that I never have to go back to wherever the fuck I came from. You know, my grandma went there with, she would talk about this, like the place that she came from. It's a mountain town. They didn't have indoor plumbing until the late 90s. So if you had to take a shit, you had to go outside. She was considered rich because I think she had a sheep and a couple of chickens, and that made her rich. She traded her entire net worth for a ticket here. That made her rich. So she would say, we came here to work as a seamstress in these mills for 70 to 80 hours a week. And the thing that kept her motivated is, I don't want to fucking go back to the dump I came from. And I understand that. And that's what was so fucking respectable about this place. But the thing is that there's all that opportunity. I can't just put up pull tab signs and then go to work in the park in another part of the country. I can't go to Custer, I love Custer, South Dakota. It's a lovely, beautiful place, nice people. I can't go to Custer, South Dakota, put on a blue polo shirt, go to the Apple store, give out cards, and then start a business. Like that's a New York City thing. And it was great for that, and I loved it for that. Me wanting to leave, the first thing was just seeing other parts of the country and realizing someday I want to be in a position where I don't have to always be here. Right. My business was mostly based on walk-in. It was all walk-in business. So I put up some stuff on my website. I really started promoting my mail-in business more because I wanted to have a business someday where my address doesn't have to be here for me to make all my money. Because if I had tried to move in 2010 or 11, I'm screwed. Then there were the constant other issues with the city, which is I got in trouble for... There were a number of things. So I paid my taxes in 2012. I paid them early. I have receipts and the stamps and everything. And then I wind up getting a lien placed on my company for non-payment of those taxes. They put a warrant out on me. The warrant gets mailed to Berwick, Maine. And I don't even figure out about it until like years later because you never even sent me any messages. And there are all these people that say, well, when the smoke, there's fire. And I just, at some point, I got tired of being abused. It's over and over and over again. There's this narrative with business, which is that people move to Texas or places like this to save money in taxes. And that's not it at all. Like, no small business that has a clientele from 8.5 million people go someplace that has 800,000 people to save a couple of percentage on their taxes. That's not how this shit works. I gave up money coming here. What I did is I got myself a more peaceful. I make less money now, but I have a more peaceful life. And that's what matters to me in my mid-30s. I want a more peaceful life. But the thing is, it's not about what the tax rate is. It's about knowing what I'm going to pay. So like I had an audit that lasted for 2.5 years where it was something like they wanted additional $40,000 or $50,000 a quarter. And at the end of it, I owed something like $500. Like they thought my error rate was 50 or 80%. And then after fighting back and forth for years, my error rate was 0.01%. 0.01%. And that's only because I agreed to a deal that I honestly shouldn't have even agreed to. I wound up getting an IRS audit literally, I think 4 or 5 days after that audit ended. Nice fucking coincidence there. My accountant of 15 years said this had never happened, but whatever. And at this time, I said, you know what? No, I'm not. Nope. Not doing it. I'm not playing that game. I don't care if I spend the rest of my life going over this. No. And after 2.5 years of that, I had a 0% error rate. And it's like, I don't think that this is because New York City is after me or something like that. I think they treat everybody like this. They treat every business owner the way that the way that the star quarterback of the football team or the hot cheerleader in high school treats the people that are average. You know, you can get away with treating people like shit because there's always going to be somebody else lining up to take your place. And so that's why I left. I wanted a lower stress life, and I didn't want to live someplace where I just had to constantly feel stress and literally lose hair. You could see when I was going through this. You could see the timeline on YouTube. Like my hairline is receding as I'm discussing these issues. I wanted a simpler life, and I wanted to live someplace where I was not getting fucked all the time over all these things that I didn't do. There are lots of tax evaders in New York, and I've met them. I worked for one of them for 4 days, and I quit because I'm like, fuck this place. They were scammers.
Right.
When I'm actually being honest, and I have to go through all this crap, it's like you realize if you go after somebody worth $40 billion, the 0.01% you get is going to be worth more than what you get from me, right? But, yeah. And also in Austin, what I like is if you want to go in the middle of nowhere and be in a mountain, you can do that. If you want to go be right next to the orchestra, you got that. If you want to go in the hills, if you want to be able to go boating, you have all this stuff within a half hour of each other. So there's something for everybody here. Yeah, like if you want HOA hell, you have that. I mean, there's everything here. There's rich areas, there's poor areas, there's middle of nowhere areas, nature areas. Like, you get everything.
No, I love it. I mean, you bring up a really good point. It's like, not necessarily that you came here for a business opportunity. You came here because the stress level was lower. You know, there's a certain kind of ethos here. People are friendlier, you know? I feel like places like LA or New York, there really isn't an ethos anymore because it's so driven by this, you know, by these necessities to kind of like survive and thrive. And like, also for me, you know, I just feel like as somebody in the kind of, you know, culture space, it's harder for me to make something meaningful there that I think actually has some kind of like, you know, that excites me long-term, or I think, you know, doesn't kind of sell out, you know, because I still think that these things matter. It just makes a lot more sense, you know, in a lot of strange ways. And, you know, there's this whole idea I think young people have in their 20s. They're like, I'm too good to live in Houston, Texas. I'm too good to live in Indianapolis, Indiana. I don't believe anybody's too good to live in, you know, tier 2, 3 metropolises in the United States, because it's really what you do with that, you know, that's what actually matters. It's not... You know, all these places, like you said, they have everything every other place has, except the stress is just so much lower. Like, you know, I'm from LA, and, you know, a big proportion of the city just burned down because of mismanagement. Because, you know, there's there's not a lot of thought. There are so many layers of, I don't know if it's legislature and just, you know, there are so many different factors and variables that go into the potential for making your life a stressful hellhole that I just don't think exist here. You know, those barriers, they don't exist. You know, it's more of
I think they're going to come back at some point. Like, when I walk down in Austin, I see a lot of empty real estate. Not as much as New York City, but you see a lot of that whole commercial space for lease, and it's there for 3 years, and the price is ridiculous. Check. New York City used to be a place where you got all these small business owners from all over the world showing up, and then you kind of have, and as time went on, it slowly turned into luxury condos for rich people's children. It was kind of like a playground for rich people's kids. You have, and I see that happening here, the gentrification part, and also the live music stuff. I like that there's live music here. You know, look at how many live music venues were in Manhattan in 2007, and then look at how many live music venues are in Manhattan in 2025. I mean,
barely.
It's gone. I mean, yeah, even when I was crazy. There, like a lot of the stuff that I stayed there for, as I said, if you're dating the Chad quarterback in high school or the hot cheerleader, like at the very least, this is probably a horrible analogy, but like, you're going out with somebody that's popular and they're hot, but they treat you like shit. And but then if they lose that, like you're not popular, you're not attractive, and you have a horrible personality, like what am I doing with you? And so I'm paying all this money to live in a place where if I want to listen to live music, I don't even know where the fuck to go anymore. I mean, there are so many places that would exist that went out of business. And then when a new one pops up, it's out of business 18 months later. Now here, I see people complaining about the same thing. And here's the thing,
it's not even comparable.
I wouldn't be surprised if in 15 or 20 years that Austin has it becomes New York City in that way.
Right.
I see people getting priced out. I see, but at the same time, it's not there yet. I'll worry about that 15 to 20 years.
Exactly.
Yeah.
In 15 to 20 years, I don't think I'll be going to that many live concerts, honestly. You know, I'll be
20 years. I hope I'm not dead.
Yeah. Same. I mean, at the rate we're going, but you know, that's a really good point, you know, cause I just thought, you know, I was back in California for a year. I was just thinking like that nothing is permittable anymore. You know, it's like, if I wanted to, you know, when you talked about, you know, starting a business in New York City, you know, me kind of starting my own, I don't know, I had a quasi repair business, you know, you just go on Recycle, you go on Craigslist. There is money to be made everywhere. But now it's like, I don't even think the thing is, if you establish yourself there, that's one thing. Granted, your profession didn't get automated away, but to me, it's almost just like the place, they're so image-based that when you look at what's actually happening, you know, culture is kind of being pushed to the side and civilization is kind of is at the forefront. You know, what's interesting now? It's, you know, people built, you know, nuclear fusion, you know, harnessing the power from like artificial suns. Like this is the stuff that I think people are actually interested in and are talking about, because all these other cultural spaces have gone away because there's been a structural collapse that hasn't, you know, it's come for these places first. These are the first places to move in and sort of quote unquote gentrify the areas, but they're also kind of like the first structures to leave, you know, into, you know, become replaced after obviously the people that they replaced before them. So it's a really sort of interesting situation. I don't know.
I hope to see something different happen here than what happened in New York.
Right.
I hate walking down the street and seeing all these small businesses that used to be run by people that were like the best in their field. This, where you walk in, you could see the owner in the back with his trainee. This was the best place to go to get your vacuum repaired. This is the best place to go if you wanted your speakers built and or phase coherent or whatever. Okay, I'm reaching there, but I like those little places that were the experts best in their field. Go here. This person works there 80 hours a week, and his motivation is to be the best at what he does and to have to never go back to the place he came from, where you know you don't have plumbing until the late 90s kind of thing. I miss that. To see that just be Starbucks, Chase, Whole Foods, Starbucks, Chase, Whole Foods. I mean, the place that I had one of my best first dates as a teenager, early 20s, it used the restaurant Cosi on 13th and Broadway. I'm never going to forget it. It's a Santander Bank ATM. It's not even a bank. It's a fucking ATM. It's like,
yeah,
you're killing me. Like, you're killing me. I walk around and it's, I don't get what you're billing this much for anymore, because the experience that I used to have there is not there. And like, right. I'll read these comments on Reddit, and there's always these oversimplified narratives. Duh, he just moved to be in a red state and saving taxes. It's like, yeah, I save like 3% in taxes for the loss of 40% of my revenue. Like,
right.
That's Reddit math for you. It's like, there's so much more shit to it than that. There's so much more going on there.
Yeah, to me, it's cultural. You know, it's like I've always sort of, you know, when I was a kid, I always had these fantasies about cowboys and Indians. You know, I was really obsessed with cowboys and Indians and like this sort of Wild West and, you know, Larry McMurtry novels and movies, you know? So for me, it was like, it was almost cultural, you know, like I didn't do this for business reasons. I did this because I don't want to die of a heart attack by the time I'm like 45 years old. And, you know, it's also like, there's more things to life than just business and making money and setting career goals and personal growth. You know,
yeah, like, I mean, I would have more money if I stayed in New York City. Again, the state, I think like the state tax, I forget, it was like 5 or 6.5%, and the city tax was like 2 or 3.5%, somewhere around there. I'm so happy that I actually forget these things, but like the amount, but I had 8.5 billion customers instead of 800 or 900,000 customers, and they all people had more money. It's like, there was more money there, but what is the point of the money? The point of the money is financial security. The house I live in now, like a middle-class person could buy where I live. I have a gorgeous view out there. This shit would be $10 or $20 million in New York City. I will never, like, if you are worth less than $4 million in New York City, you are constantly reminded that you are poor. Whether right. it is wanting to hire a contractor to do some basic shit, and the only person that's even remotely qualified is $150,000 for a basic job that would cost $20 or $30K anywhere else, or whether you're dealing with anything, just starting a business. I mean, even just looking for a basic space to do business out of. When you walk through Manhattan, when you walk through a lot of parts of Brooklyn, you want $300 a square feet for this shithole. I mean, like you, a space that's the size of my fucking living room, and you want $35,000 or $28,000 a month for this. It's, you feel poor. You're reminded every single right. day that if you are a normal person, you are poor. And it sucks.
Demoralizing.
And at some point, yeah. I don't want to, yeah, like it was useful for the time that I had it, but what's the point of making all that money and doing all that shit unless I have it? I want the security. I have a right. nice view. I have 50 or 70, actually. There's no ortho ever for fish, so probably closer to 100 now. There's about 100 fish in my backyard. I have peace and quiet. If I want to go see live music, I can see live music because the venues can actually afford to pay the rent. So that they even pay their musicians. Like, there are places here where they don't do this shit. Like, I just had this giant argument over this shit with LMG and like going to a conference. That's another thing altogether. But like, the musicians here actually get paid by the venues sometimes. In New York City, there's none of that shit. You go to like Arlene's Groceries or Pianos in the late 90s, and it was all this crap of, there's going to be an A&R person in the audience and, right. on Wednesday night. And like, if you play, maybe he'll notice you. Like, it's that exposure shit. It's like exposure yeah. and beer. It's like, bitch, I'll
exposure
buy my own
doesn't
beer
even mean enough. Anything anymore.
If I want, you know? Dude, if I want exposure, I'll turn the fucking knob on my camera. Like, I don't, yeah. I don't want exposure. If
well, I'm that's what South by Southwest used to be. It used to be a place where all the A&R people and label people, like when I was playing in bands, you know, before there was a deal, because the bands I played in ended up on this label, that's why you went there. You went there because that's where they could see you and suss you out. Now it's just a tech conference, you know, you have a CIA booth where they feed you like grasshoppers and bugs and talk about sort of like, you know, global government planning. You know, it's like, what does this have to do with a music festival? And
what I like about South by Southwest is, what I really like about that time is, when you have all these people show up to Austin and all these people show up during that time to the same place from all over the world, and you do your own shit. You go to meetup.com and you say, here's during South, but not a South by Southwest thing, during South by Southwest, we will be doing this shit here. And here's what we're going to be doing. We're going to be doing our own thing. We're going to be talking about making phase coherent loudspeakers that have high sensitivity and good baffle diffusion. So I don't know, whatever the fuck it is. Like, people who have their own little niches, who have their own, you know, the Tori Amos Live at Montreal from 1992 music club or something. Like, that's what I like. And I like living someplace where I get that amount of diversity. I can meet all these different types of people, and they actually somewhat have the ability to live here and do business here. I like being able to listen to live music. I don't want to pay $2,300 a month to live in the ghetto, to be 40 minutes away from the city, all so that I can walk by a bunch of commercial space release. Like, this just, it doesn't do it for me. And then get punished on top of it nonstop when I'm actually obeying the law and doing nothing wrong. It's like, I like it. I don't know.
It's like Harvard Yard, or what's it called in Manhattan, or in Greenpoint, the development area, you know, it's like so dystopian. It's crazy.
Yeah. Like Greenpoint used to be a kind of poor middle-class Polish neighborhood that I have friends and employees that grew up there. Like they bought these people, like their parents are poor, and they bought this house with a horrible mortgage for $100K, and so they could sell it now for $6 million.
It's crazy.
but like a normal person can't do that shit today. The type of person that will buy that is somebody who has, you know, mommy and daddy's money and sees the city as a playground for the people with wealthy parents. And it's not the same vibe. It's not like when I was talking about before, when I was saying how I got along with the studio technicians when I worked at Avatar, not the production assistants. The technicians were that old New York 60s, 70s, 80s attitude. The you know, hey, I'm walking here, that with the parents that ran this watch repair shop that worked 80 hours a week there. And then there were the production assistants. It's like their parents have enough money to fund them showing up to working at a studio where there's an internship where they don't get paid, with the whole like, the original vinyl is actually better. I'm surprised that you don't even have that. Didn't you say you cared about this? Like, suck my dick, bro.
Right.
Like, there's hippies and then there's hipsters. Hippies, right. I respect. I get along with you. I can vibe with you. The old New York City plumber type people, like the techs, like, I vibe with you. The hipsters, like, gargle my balls. But it shifted. Like, that kind of thing shifted. And what I like about Austin the most is it has everything you want in one place. If I want to meet hippies, I can meet hippies. If I want to meet hipsters, I can meet hipsters. If I want to meet a bunch of annoying, you know, tech bro people, you can meet them. If I want to meet people who are actually into tech and not just like the negative stereotype there,
right,
I can meet them. If I want to meet people that are fishing by a lake, I can drive 4 minutes. I want to see the symphony orchestra, I drive 25 minutes. I want to go into the busy city district, it's like, you know, 20 minutes for that. I want to go into HOA hell, it's 15 minutes away. I personally don't live in HOA hell. If I want to go to a brewery that makes their own beer and plays live music, that shit's across the street. Like, you have everything you want in this small area. It has something for everybody, and it's all within a 20 to 25 minute drive. And that's what I think makes this. Yeah, that's what I like
amazing.
About these places.
Yeah,
you got all this different stuff that you could want. There's something for everybody here. It doesn't matter what your lifestyle is like.
Right.
You know,
and it's affordable too, you know.
Some people would dispute that.
They would dispute that, but it's more affordable. You know, I was watching some video, and it was had to do with some girl was like, "What's your advice for an artist in like New York City?" And she's just like, "Just start it. Just don't wait for somebody to open the door for you." It's like, well, there are things that are cost prohibitive. You know, time is a kind of value too. It's like people, the average person in New York is going to have to work 60 hours just so they could start their own business on the side most of the time.
The entire point of being an artist in New York, from my experience, was this type of thing where you are like, you're playing at Pianos or Arlene's Grocery or whatever the fuck is that version of that now in the Lower East Side, and you get noticed by somebody in the audience, and that record exec in the audience takes you under their wing or something. Or even if that doesn't happen, you're playing these venues and you're playing them all the time and you're getting noticed by people. But what are the venues? Where are you playing? I mean, most of these places don't even exist anymore. You're going to play at BB King's? That died before I even started my freaking business, I think. It does. Like, a lot of these awesome places don't exist. I remember seeing this one. I grew up in the age of Nutella, Napster, Kaza, iMesh. Emule, Usenet becoming popular, and people saying that $20 for an album is a ripoff. $20 is way too much, right? I grew up with all these people. Do you think it's right or wrong? So many people thought that shit and would just say that to justify, you know, never paying artists. And then the same people that I grew up with, I'll be watching Twitch, and they'll be saying, I'm never going to forget this. There's this one kid, you know, self-bleep proclaimed, very autistic, on Twitch, and he's playing his keyboard, and he's freaking amazing. I wish I had 1% of talent that this guy did. It's absolutely insane. And he's like, I think 13 or 14 years old, and he's just playing his keyboard. His parents probably set up his account, and he was a genius. This kid made $217 to $230 over the course of 10 minutes, just taking random requests from the audience. And like, I don't know where he lives. That kid could be in Custer, South Dakota. That kid could be in New Ipswich, New Hampshire. He could be in the middle of a swamp. I have no idea where he lives, and it doesn't matter. There's a different way of getting exposure now. If you're, don't get me wrong, it's still difficult. Like, people will say, well, you know, building a channel is not easy. It's like, yeah, working 80 hours a week to live with seven people in a place that's going to eat you alive is also not easy.
Right.
But you don't need to do that anymore as an artist. You get your Patreon, Twitch, YouTube, all these social media things. If you're even Reddit, whatever else it is, if you're really amazing as an artist, you don't need to be in New York City anymore. There's a lot of other areas that are not only more affordable, but where you're going to meet a lot of artists. I mean, you'll meet a lot of artists in Austin. You're going to meet a lot of artists in New York City.
No, it's true.
You know, if you live in, I don't know if it's still like this, like Bushwick used to be a kind of an immigrant community, for like a Spanish immigrant community. And then it started to turn into a broke hipster, hippie community, then like a broke hipster community, then a rich one. You know, I remember on 247 Star Street, there used to be this place, Las Palmas, is a beautiful, amazing, like my favorite Mexican restaurant. I went there 3 times a day. You know, it's a real Mexican restaurant when I have to point on the menu or use a translator because they don't understand what I'm saying. Like, that's the best. Like, you know, because I know it's going to be authentic and it's beautiful. I love going to that place. And then I went back to it sometime around 2016 or 18. And there was a place there where it cost, I think, like $25 for a shot of Grey Goose. And it's like, this is, or I know it wasn't Grey Goose. It was Absolute, because at Grey Goose, at least you can justify it. It's like, what the hell is this? Like, what is this? It's like, that's not what I'm there for.
Well, you bring up a really good point. Even if you're making more money in New York, there's still that feeling in LA where it's like, I feel like I'm getting ripped off for this. Like, you know, I would eat some burger, it'd be like $20, and it's just the lettuce is wilted. You know, California is a food desert. There's no, you know, there's no natural farming there. It's the water reservoirs are all messed up. It's, you know what I mean? So it's like, I'd always feel like I could get this same thing for $6 in Austin and it actually tastes better. You know, there's a direct link from the source of where you're getting it right to my hands. You know, it's like the mediations of exchange are so much less. And I think that actually, you know, that really increases the quality of life and like somebody being able to do business. And you bring up a good point. It's like, you can have a Patreon anywhere. I mean, that's what I do, you know. At the same time, it's like, if you're looking for collaborators and people want you to do on the ground research, you know, going to these places, you know, you'll have everything at your fingertips. But a lot of these scenes, a lot of these kind of like social networks, they don't last. They don't have a lasting lifespan. You know, what does last is right to repair. What does last is, you know, consumer protections. These are things that are ostensibly supposed to, you know, navigate this. They're supposed to go beyond the timetable of the zeitgeist. And I think that, to me, that's always what I'm focused on, is like, I don't care about the zeitgeist. Like, my thing is that the zeitgeist is something to transcend, you know? So.
Yeah. My next project going forward is the thing that I think I've been like converging on is general consumer protection and ownership. You know, the fixing Mac. I don't think I'm going to be remembered for fixing MacBooks, having a small business. I don't think I'll be remembered for teaching people how to fix motherboards or like fixing boards when Apple said you couldn't. Even getting the right to repair stuff passed, like, I don't think that's it. I think my purpose is something related to general consumer protection. My latest project, I've been so excited and spent so much time on this. It's just a basic wiki that anybody can edit. No logins, no registration, no nothing like that. All it is every time a company has changed the terms of the sale. So they say, you know, like, this is an item that we released. Like, this is a Silicon Dust HD home run. Let's just use this as an example. To be clear, Silicon Dust would never do this. This is a great device. Just an example. This is a device that you could use to capture HDTV. It is, you pay $300 and you get it and it works. And then next year when they come out the new one, they say, oh, actually, this has to connect to the internet. And it every single time it connects to the internet, it checks whether or not it's allowed to work. And then next year when they make the new one, this one stops working. Every time a company does this type of shit, the idea is to log that in this wiki so that every single type of anti-consumer fuckery, whether it's LG telling you that your warranty on your refrigerator is void, because in the side of the box is a forced arbitration agreement that you don't see, or whether it's something like this. Every time a company changes the terms of the sale, every time there's an app like Musio that says pay $10 to get rid of the ads, and then 3 months later, they fill the application with ads, I want to have a centralized repository for it. And then I want to have a browser extension like uBlock Origin or SponsorBlock or something like that, that has all that will then reference this when you're on that product page. So if you're about to buy this thing, you have a little exclamation point in the corner saying, warning, voids warranty against the law. Warning, takes calls a lifetime license only lasts for 3 months, something like that. So because there is no consumer protection in the U.S. and it has to start with people becoming informed about it. It has to start people getting informed about it, understanding what's happening to them, and then being able to fight back directly in very easy ways. Like being able to make a purchase decision saying, I was this close to buying this, but you sent out an update to everybody that had this phone and you forced it on them that caused the battery life to go from 8 hours to 1 hour.
Right.
And you're not going to tell me why.
Right.
And the new batteries that you're replacing it with don't actually work right. Like, okay, I'll think twice before I buy your shit. But it has to be organized. It can't just be random Reddit posts. It can't just be hidden on a forum. It can't 100%. Just be this do your own research shit where it's like fucking page 72 of something on XDA developers. It has to be something people can see.
That's an amazing project. I think the repository has to make a big comeback because as information gets, there's so much bloat out there. We really need a way to sort of centralize things and kind of bring them into, I think, more of like a specified canon, you know? So if you could do that with all the updates, what they do, how they're screwing you over, that's an incredible project. I mean,
yeah, there's the different categories. Like the first one is changing the terms of the sale. The second one is, and I used to, there was this ad campaign in 2020 where all these car manufacturers funded advertisements that made you believe if you were able to fix your own car or get independence to be able to get access to what they need to fix your car, that they would hack your car, figure out where you are, follow you, and then rape you in a parking lot. they were using sexual assault on there. Like there was in the text, they were saying this domestic violence advocates say that this is how this is bad for you. I mean, it was complete bullshit. But they were essentially making the arguments that like we're rapists and you have to be scared of us because of what we're doing and what we're suggesting. So I've kind of tried to turn it on them. And one of the terms I use is the EULA roofie, end user license agreement roofie. What that means is you have some bullshit buried in page 90 of your terms of service that I would never consent to if I knew it was fucking there. You're trying to get consent under a false pretense. So EULA roofie, when a company, like for instance, Sony and Discovery, Sony says purchase when you buy this movie, $15, $10, you bought the movie. But on page 21, it redefines purchase. It redefines own. It says these words have their own meaning. When I check Oxford or Webster Dictionary, for some, it says that this word, you came up with this meaning in the 14th fucking century, and somehow Sony thinks they could redefine it in 2023. Fuck you. I want people to be informed. What is a EULA roofie? What does changing the terms of the sale mean? What does this whole subscription thing mean? What does it mean when I can't fix what I own? Like, these are the particular items that are the issue. And then cataloging every time a company has a product or a service that has this, and then having real citations. This can't be like Yelp. This can't be Google reviews. This can't be my plumber didn't attach the hose spigots properly, you know, or it's welded right. And then when there was a freeze, everything popped off again. Like, that's not what it's for. It's to educate people on specific topics and then come up with the easiest way possible that they could figure out if they're buying something or about to use a product from a company that screws them. I don't know if this is going to work, but I know the last FTC chair was the most progressive person in our time, and she managed to not even fine companies a dollar when they voided warranty law. Harley Davidson, $0, voided warranty law if you fix something on your own motorcycle.
Wow.
Yeah, if you fix something on your own motorcycle, they weren't following the Magnuson-Moss standard, which is I have to prove that what you did to your motorcycle broke it. So if you take a hammer and you use that to open up your shit instead of a screwdriver, like, that's on you. But if we produced a faulty product, that's on us. They don't use that standard. They said if you replace things, well, it's on you. You broke it. Like, they broke the law. The FTC acknowledged they broke the law. They charged them $0. Weber Grills, $0. All these other companies got charged nothing. And this is from one of the most progressive FTC chairs of our time. The new FTC chair doesn't even dissent. He dissented on one-click cancel. He thinks that you should have to sign up for something with one click, and then to cancel, you have to do 5 or 20. And he never even said why. And I know why he didn't say why. Because if he said why, people would realize, you're not on my side. This isn't Democrat or Republican. Nobody would say that if I can cancel my gym membership, if I could pay for my gym membership online, that I wouldn't also be able to hit cancel online. That doesn't make sense.
Right.
If I can buy the gym membership online, why do I have to send you certified mail to cancel? Why do I have to show up in person to cancel? Why can't I have a cancel button there? Explain to me the defense. And the
they make it really hard.
Yeah. So like the point here is to get, we're not being protected. And it's very obvious going forward, we're not being protected by any of these agencies and we have to do it ourselves. So I want to try and create a knowledge base and that allows people to do that for themselves. So my dream is a little browser extension, a wiki that has, you know, thousands of maintainers, millions of contributors. That's how Sponsor Block and uBlock work. You just got millions of people that put in 4 seconds a week this was an ad. This is a malicious IP. Somebody else checks it. Yes, it is. And it just goes in there. And then magically, the internet just has its ads removed. It's not because of a company worth millions of dollars. It's because of millions of pissed off people putting in 4 seconds a week from their bedroom or their pajamas. When they're, I want that. I want to make that. And then hopefully you can have a little browser extension, something on your phone, right before you buy something, right before you download something. This company collected all of your data and then sold it to insurance companies and used that information to raise your insurance rates. Just so you know, before you install this. And then when you click it, you have the citations. You got all those citations that say, like, here's the receipts, here's the lawsuit, here's the court findings. It's a big task to take on, but yeah. I've got, like, people are making over 1,000 edits a day right now, and I want to see where this goes.
That's incredible. I've been meaning to check this out, but you know, I've gotten pretty busy, but I'm definitely going to dive in as soon as possible. So what else is there anything else that's on your mind? Anything else you'd like to sort of impart or share?
The main thing is that change starts with you. Don't tell people what to think. I've done that before and I've screwed up. I know I've done that. And every time I do it, I feel, you lead them to it by getting, you have to get them excited about what you're talking about. Like when you know somebody with rights repair, when you know somebody that is almost about to pay $3,000 for something and they have a $75 problem, the way you get them hooked is not yelling at them and scolding them. You get them hooked by showing them that and getting that kick of dopamine and getting them that excitement. And also, don't believe that it's useless to get involved. Don't listen to the oversimplified narratives that, don't listen to the idea that, well, there's no point in going here. All the lobbies are going to win anyway. Yeah, you're right. They show up all the time. But it's not about the envelope. And you can get a lot more done if you show up. And if everybody believes it's hopeless, then you're right. The thing is, if every single person watching this thinks it's hopeless and it's pointless, then you're all right, because none of you are going to show up. It takes one person to show up and say, fuck this shit. And I don't think that I do that because I'm brave. I don't do that because I'm smart. I don't do that because I'm a good person. I do that because I'm crazy. And, you know, maybe I think it takes a crazy person to get it started. And hopefully then sane people and the intelligent people and the people that actually have something inside their brain, but, you know, dead space will actually do something too. It was a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Where do people find this so I can post it on my community page?
It'll be up on Patreon, but this one will be public also on Spotify and a few others. Because I think this is an important subject.
Where do you post it? Like, what else do you post it? I don't even have a Spotify account.
I post it actually mostly on Patreon. So that's usually where these things go up first, and then a week later I'll release them to the public. I actually really want to take everything off of Spotify just because they're screwing us over so bad.
If I want people in my audience to be able to watch this and like link to you and hopefully you gain some subscribers from it
The Patreon is the number one place to go for that. So
okay.
Well, cool. Yeah, I'll send that to you, and once it's up, I'll let you know.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Have a great rest of your day.
And sorry it took so long. That was really shitty of me to keep forgetting about that. My bad.
No worries. I know you're busy. You got more important stuff to deal with. So
I wouldn't say more important, but I do get stuck at things. Right. Pleasure talking to you.